Okay, we're gonna. My goal in this class is to get you psyched for Passover. You ready?
No.
I mean, how many of you guys are excited for the holiday? Yeah.
Yeah.
Really? Okay, awesome. Good.
There you go.
Hey, Jenna, you're eating as much chametz exactly. as possible.
Give it to me.
Actually, the Passover Seder, I believe, is the.
Monday the 23rd.
We're at always advertising, always selling, always be closing. We're having a Passover Seder, if anybody's interested. The first night downtown at our downtown site, and the second night will be here. Rabbi Ezra's running the first night, and Leora and Aaron are running the second night up here if anybody needs an actual Seder. And next week, we're going to start this class a little earlier. I'm going to pray earlier in the day and get here on time. We're going to start like 10 to 7, so 6:45, 7, so we can get a little more time. We're going to do what's called a mock Seder. Don't try this at home. It's a, you should try it at home. That's the whole point. But it's going to give you some tools and some things you can sound intelligent at your Seder, like you know what you're talking about. We're going to go through the basics of the Haggadah and the Seder, I was about to say, is probably the most observed Jewish ritual in America. Do you know that? More Jews attend a Seder than any other Jewish ritual. And I'm going to start with that. How did that happen? How did the Seder get so popular? And why is it that Jews who were kind of removed from their Judaism, let's say religious practice, started going crazy? And to this day, to some degree, go a little crazy in preparing for the holiday. Jewish people who are not terribly, scrupulous, let's say, about their Sabbath observance are like taking out all their pots and pans and koshering them and cleaning their homes. And there are these funny videos going around of people like scrubbing their toilets, which, by the way, you don't have to do unless you like eating in the bathroom. And that's just weird. Just like people really going crazy about Passover. Now, one of the reasons people go crazy about Passover is because the Torah goes crazy about Passover. Can anybody give me examples of when we make reference to the Passover holiday? Every Friday night, when we say the Kiddush, we mention one of the two reasons that the Torah gives for observing the holiday of Passover. One is to commemorate creation, that God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. But it also says, because God took us out of Egypt. And we somehow have to remember that on Shabbat. Spoke about that a little last week. What else? When else do we reference Passover?
When
we say the grace after meals.
Shema.
Okay? We say the Shema twice a day. Jews are supposed to say the Shema. And there's a whole paragraph, the third and last paragraph of the Shema, references, I took you out of Egypt. Also interesting, when God revealed himself at Sinai to the Jewish people, how did he introduce himself? Like if you were God, you would probably say, I'm the one who, without boasting, I'm the one who created the world. God did not introduce himself that way. What's the first of the Ten Commandments? Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God. Not Asher bara et ha'olam, not who created the world, but Asher hotzeiticha me'eretz Mitzrayim, who took you out of Egypt. Like, why is that so significant? Any other references? What else am I missing? What else am I missing when we reference the Exodus all the time? What about Passover itself? How many commandments are there in Judaism?
613.
There are a lot. 613. Anybody know how many commandments there are? Welcome. How many commandments there are just not to have this thing called chametz, which we're going to talk about. First of all, let's learn how to pronounce it properly. How many of you guys can cha? Okay.
Cha.
Oh, wow. Very good. It's very guttural. That's amazing.
It's very phlegmy.
It's very phlegmy. You're Flemish. So chametz refers to this bread that is allowed to rise. Right? It's actually any one of the five types of wheat, of grains, wheat, barley, rye, spelt, and oats, that comes into contact with water for 18 minutes or longer. If you go to a matzah baking, and by the way, what's matzah? Same stuff. except they cut it short. They make sure that it doesn't leaven. They have to pull it out of the oven before the 18 minutes. So it's interesting that what's forbidden on the holiday and what's commanded on the holiday are basically the same ingredients, except for
time.
I'm going to come back to that. But I want to just keep building this case. We've got all of these prohibitions. You're not allowed to own chametz. You're not allowed to possess chametz. You're not allowed to get hana'a. What's hana'a? Means you're not allowed to get enjoyment. Even if you don't eat it. Okay, this is going to be weird. What does that mean, getting enjoyment? How do you get enjoyment of chametz if you're not eating it?
Smelling it.
Smell it? Good. I wasn't even thinking about smelling.
Looking at it. Owning at it.
Well, I mean, if you really get such a high from looking at that devil dog,
yeah, wow.
You got bigger problems.
Wait, looking at it, I'm just imagining going into your stomach, like,
right, just,
so good.
Well, smelling, you can't fantasize about chametz? I don't think you, I don't know if there's a problem.
Carbs are carbs.
Carbs are carbs. Anybody here own a pet?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So, what happens when you feed your pet food?
Salvation.
Happy.
Who does it make happy?
The dog.
And?
And you.
Yeah. So you're benefiting when you feed your pet. Now, a lot of pet food is not really chametz. It's like what's called kidney oats, which is only rabbinically forbidden and only in Ashkenazim. And it's okay for your dog, even if it's an Ashkenazic dog, it's a German Shepherd. You can still feed your pet kidney out, because there's no isar now by kidney out. There's no prohibition of getting pleasure, but you can't feed your dog, and a lot of dog food and pet food, cat food, some cat food. I just found out. I don't have any pets, and even fish food, I'm told, has some grains in it. Not all. So you can't technically, so you have to really, so I just went to a whole class, I went to an hour-long class last Shabbat by another rabbi. It was all about pets, and I don't even own one. And he basically said that, you know, some people sell their chametz, so it's kind of like a loophole, meaning you can't eat the chametz, but let's say you don't want to throw out all the chametz that you have in your house, you can just put it aside, lock it up in a room, and then you could sell it. Okay, so some people say you should also add your pet to the sale. Yeah. And so it's not your dog. So even though your dog is enjoying chametz,
but you can be giving it to them?
Technically, because it's not your chametz. Well, you can't really you'd have to have somebody else feeding it, because you can't handle the food, really.
It's like getting
wet food.
What's that?
Like wet food for a cat.
Oh, that's, I don't
and
even
they
know.
They still have it.
I didn't even ask this question. That's a very good question about if it's not yours, listen, you go to work or you go to someone's home or your family or anyone is not observing these things, as long as it's not yours, you can be around the chametz. That's not a problem. Okay? You're just not supposed to partake of it yourself, and you're not supposed to possess or own it. Okay? Okay, but let's go back to the philosophy. Why do we obsess over chametz and Passover and Exodus? Okay, we're not the only people, unfortunately, to have been enslaved and subsequently emancipated. Okay, and this happened how long ago? I mean, when was the Emancipation Proclamation declared? Okay, yeah, a few hundred years ago. And, okay, slavery was a big deal in African-American history. It's a terrible stain in American history, and we talk about it all the time, but it's not ritualized nearly as much as the Seder is, and as Passover, and all these observances, and we're 3,000 years old, this slavery thing. Like, get over it, move on. Why are we still talking about it? Like, why is it even relevant to our lives? One day there were Jews that were slaves. Okay, move on. We're not slaves anymore. Look at us, living it up, New York City. What is so fundamental? What is so fundamental about? So, take a look at the handout. Passover commemorates the redemption of the Jewish people. I wrote this. From the shackles of slavery under Egyptian rule. God inflicting the 10 plagues, splitting the Red Sea, freeing the Jews. We were slaves for 210 years under what was the greatest empire in the world. Manifested what? His mastery over nature and showed his hand in history. It was the exodus from Egypt which initiated the process of development of our people from a group of tribes without a purpose to a nation with a mission. The Jews were taken out of Egypt. Now, stop for a second. This is really important. There are a lot of people who believe that God, there's a God that created the world. Very hard to explain a lot of the natural phenomena. If you ever heard of the famous argument from intelligent design, it's a very old argument used by Muslims, Christians, Jews, you know, monotheists, that you can't really explain the sophisticated makeup of the human anatomy, the galaxies, the solar system, fish life, plant life. It's very hard to explain without a deliberate creator that somehow all of this exploded into existence on its own, randomly. So a lot of people believe in God, but how many people believe that God is still involved in the world? And that's what Passover really celebrates, fundamentally. That God is not just a God of creation, he's a God of history. Now what does that have to do with the Exodus? Because that was the first time that we see in the Torah where God intervenes in history, where God gets involved. A nation which is oppressed and persecuted cries out, and God says, I'm here. It's the first time that God... Now, of course, we have instances before then of God talking to people, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Rebekah, Rachel, and Leah, but he's not playing with history. Here, he's getting involved in history because the Egyptian Empire, by the way, I just did some interesting research. I'm a little bit history buff. Does anybody know? The Egyptian Empire was the longest empire of any empire in human civilization ever.
Yeah, because they created pyramids.
Well, besides the pyramids, and they're unbelievable.
Well, they preserved the mummies.
They were in existence for 1,000 years before the Passover story.
Wow. Crazy.
The Jews were emancipated. We were slaves for just the last 200 plus years. Okay? And we got the 10 plagues, and we got the splitting of the Red Sea, and all of this drama that unfolds. And by the way, there's a new Netflix series. A friend of mine is one of the rabbis who was interviewed on it. It's called Moses. It's actually pretty good. What's that?
Testament of Moses, something like that.
Yeah, I saw like two. I thought it was pretty good.
It's good.
And it really details a lot of, you know, the whole Exodus story. And so that's really the fundamental idea I wanted to share with you tonight. That, you know, like, let's say you're a watchmaker. So you build this beautiful watch, right? And then you sell it to a retailer, and the retailer sells it in a store. And then what's the relationship between the watchmaker and the watch? It's gone. And that watchmaker goes on, and that watch goes on, and the person wearing the watch continues to go on, and there's no real connection between the creator of the watch and the person wearing the watch at some point. But do we believe that? Do we believe that God sort of created the world, set it on automatic timer, and took off? Now, what Judaism fundamentally believes is that God stays involved in the world. Now, I can't pretend that I know exactly how God stays involved and why he, you know, shows his hand to us very clearly, like in the Exodus story, but is silent at other moments when we call out to God, and that's very distressing and difficult. I do think a lot of us are troubled by that. Where was God during the Holocaust? Where was God on October 7th? I think we're troubled by that because somehow we believe deep down that God is not just a God of creation, but he's also a God of history. And if he's a God of history, why is he not intervening in history? Why is he not helping us, you know, kill the bad guys? I mean, I think he is a little, but why is he not stopping bad things from happening to good people? I mean, that's a whole other class. We believe in free will. There are all sorts of answers to this question. But that doesn't mean that God is not involved. You know, a lot of people are trying to make sense of the Holocaust, and don't try. They say, well, you know, because if you want to put God in a human box, you'll say, either God's not powerful enough to intervene and to stop the Nazis, or he doesn't care. And a lot of people lost their faith after the Holocaust, because they said those are the only two options. Either he's not omnipotent, or he's not a caring, he's not a benevolent God. Judaism says he's benevolent, he's omnipotent, but sometimes he chooses to intervene and sometimes he does not. And we don't really fully understand, I don't pretend to understand, you know, God's ways, but we do know that he intervened. with the Passover story, and that it was the first time, and it sort of sets the precedent for our belief in not only of a God of creation, but a God of history. And the two major rituals of Passover express this very fundamentally. Don't eat chametz and eat matzah. What does matzah represent? What does matzah represent? It's, I mean, it's just like...
Humble?
How many guys the like rush. Matzah, actually?
No.
You don't like
no
matzah?
One likes it. People say they like it, they don't like it.
I'm telling you, I sincerely like matzah.
I like it too.
A little salted.
Yeah.
I eat it all year round. Oh,
really?
Butter it all year round.
All, you actually go out of your way to buy it?
Oh, yeah, we buy it all year round.
What's the brand that you use, Rabbi? We need to know.
What's that?
What's the brand that you use?
I get paid a lot of money.
Sponsor.
One day I'll get paid money to endorse. You see the shoes I'm wearing? I don't even know. Strides? I have no idea. Matzah's matzah. It's all, you know.
The same brands taste different every year. It just depends on.
Really?
Oh, it's
just,
respect
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, if they have a bad year, it's just that.
What does that even, how do they have
like
a bad
if,
year?
I don't know, if it's sat in their warehouse for too long, if it's whatever.
Yeah, it does, it does.
Thing,
you can't trust the brand.
It was so much better last year, it was thinner, it was
oh, that's
not
so
as hard.
It is interesting.
I don't think it has like mud.
Yeah,
like,
they've been working on it for the whole year.
Right, right.
I have a brand.
Although a lot of people like going right before to see them making it.
Oh,
you know, to go to those matzah baking fair. But let me just finish the idea. So... what is the reason the Torah tells us we're supposed to eat matzah? Specifically the night of the 15th of Nisan, which is a week from Monday night. What's the date? What's Passover? What's the date?
22nd.
What's that?
22nd.
We can't agree on anything here. 22nd? The
22nd.
Okay, at night, Monday night.
Yes.
Okay, good. So, Monday night, 22nd, there's a biblical command to eat matzah. And then the rest of the holiday also, but there's really a mitzvah the first night. What's the reason? Anybody know? What's the reason the Torah gives? It's a very specific thing to commemorate something. You remember this?
When we walked out of Egypt, like it was a new time to make bread and dry the back of the bags.
So that's a whole thing. That's why some of the Sephardic Jews at their Seder will take like the matzah and the thing and then put it over like they're leaving Egypt. But because there wasn't enough time to let the bread rise. So why is that important? That's why we have to go through this crazy ritual of eating this like cardboard tasting stuff. Because there wasn't enough time to let the bread rise. What does that say to you that they didn't have enough time to let the bread rise? What is that? That we left in a haste. Okay, and why is that significant? Who cares? As long as we got out. What does it matter? We left in a rush. We took our own sweet time. So think about it for a minute. Why were we baking bread when we were leaving Egypt? Seems like a very mundane activity to be doing. Come on, get your stuff. We're
on
going.
Your way, like,
what does that
on
show?
Your journey to eat something. You gotta have snacks or something.
Because we like to bake bread. We're bread baking people.
Yeah, but not when you're supposed to be leaving Egypt. You're a slave. Your father was a slave. His father was a slave. You're finally going.
I like sandwiches.
210 years you're waiting to get out, and now you're baking bread, and you're making sandwiches.
It wasn't planned. They didn't know that that's what they were going to get. Yeah.
And why is that significant?
God told Moses, like, we're getting out of here.
Yeah.
Okay, this was not some. It was unexpected. It was not planned, and that demonstrates what was the nature of this event. This was not a Hanukkah kind of story where we rose up. In rebellion against the oppressive Greek regime. We didn't do that against the Egyptians. We were slaves. And we didn't think for a second to be able to push back. We had a terrible slave mentality, and you can explain a lot of the stories in the Bible in the wilderness for the next 40 years. You take the Jew out of Egypt and not the Egypt out of the Jew. We were complaining. We were used to being slaves. You ever see Shawshank Redemption, one of the best movies in the world?
Yeah.
Okay, you could take someone who's institutionalized, they don't know what to do when they get out. The Jewish people were slaves, okay? God takes them out. What is that demonstrating? That even though it looked like, who was running the show? Moses came before Pharaoh and said, let my people go. And all of a sudden these plagues started happening. That's God. God was doing that. It wasn't the people. Now there are instances in Jewish history, as I mentioned, the Hanukkah story against the Greeks, where it was us and Hashem blessed us. say 1948, 1967, IDF, you know, but Hashem blessed that. And that's a very, very important idea that the matzah comes to symbolize. And that's why the matzah is flat. It's humble. And the opposite of the matzah is the bloated chametz. Mm-hmm. Chametz is leavened bread. It's filled with itself. It's convinced itself that whatever happens in life only happens because I push the buttons. It's all me. There's no other force operating in this world. And Pesach is all about demonstrating that there's another force. Now, that doesn't mean you and I don't play an important and significant part in what happens in our lives and in the world at large. We do. We make choices, and we can make bad choices, we can make good choices, and they matter. But we have to, and that's our job as the Jewish people, to point out that there's a God that didn't just create, but there's a God who's continuing to be involved in the world and in our lives. And, I'll tell you just a crazy story that I just heard. I'll tell it to you anyway. I was going to share it another time. But, you could say this whole thing since October 7th is just the bad guys against, I think, we're the good guys. Not everybody agrees. And it doesn't, people are asking, where's God? But, if you look, so my friend Rabbi Levine, he's the rabbi here at the Jewish Center, just told me that he met with a lone soldier recently who came to New York to raise money for the Lone Soldier Center in Israel. That's basically soldiers from other parts of the world who volunteer and enlist in the IDF. And he was in a tank unit, and he has two friends in the same unit, one observant, one not. And the observant friend is always running around trying to get everybody else to do mitzvahs. So he asks his less than religious friend, would you put on per tefillin? Wrap the tefillin this morning. And the guy doesn't want to do it. He says, look, I'll make you a deal. I will I'll take you out to dinner if you put on the tefillin now. And he's like, free dinner. He wasn't like against tefillin, so he put him on. As he's putting the tefillin, they're in Gaza, by the way. Now, they're off duty, and they're a tank corps. And as he's putting on the tefillin, like the light is shining in, and it's getting in his eye. So he yells to his friend who's in the tank, can you just move the tank like a couple of yards, block the sun, I get a little shade while I put my tefillin on. The tank moves, and the second the tank moves, an RPG comes whizzing by.
Oh, my God.
Misses the tank and the soldiers. The two soldiers see the Hamas terrorists, and they immediately take them out of commission, and they survive. So you can be very skeptical and say, oh, coincidence, just happened to be in the sun. I don't know, you got to be a little cynical, not to see a little God in that, And a lot of these things are happening. We would, of course, pray for more of these things, But I think that's really what Passover is about, is trying to really find those miracles and find those moments where you feel connected to something beyond yourself. And recognize that Hashem cares, and He didn't just create us and good luck, you're on your own now. He gave us a book called the Torah to follow, to have a guidebook through life, and to ultimately manifest God's spirituality in the world. That's really our chief purpose in being here, which is to reflect Hashem's holiness in the physical world, bring a little heaven down to earth. And that's Passover in a nutshell. And everything we do reflects this in one way or the other, and specifically the chametz and the matzah. But here's the thing. I could just tell you this idea, and it's nice, but the best way to internalize ideas and be impacted by ideas and to be transformed by ideas is to ritualize them and make them your behavior. So that's why we eat something, we eat the matzah, and we think about the humility, the flat, humble bread, that there's another force operating. We stay away from the bloated chametz, that which represents the ego. There's actually a beautiful prayer that some Hasidim like to say. It'll be next Sunday night, a week from this Sunday night, when we do the search for chametz. And we look around, that we're not just looking for the chametz out there. We're looking for the chametz in here. The part of us that really denies anything spiritual or anything that we can't. Look, I can't see it. It must not be there. I can't experience it with any of my senses. It must not exist. Now, that's arrogance, we believe. And that's also just not being mindful of the total reality. Because the physical world is part of reality, clearly. But it's not the total reality. There's more. And that's really what we're trying to do. So take a look at just a handout here. I'm going to go through some of the steps that we take to prepare for Passover. Take a look at the second paragraph. We'll just continue on the front page. The second paragraph, the Jews were taken out of Egypt in such a haste. It's just summarizing what we said. But the bread they were baking did not have time to rise. This demonstrates that the Jews did not plan their escape. If they did, they certainly would have prepared some essentials for the road. The redemption was completely accomplished by God. A primary aspect of Passover, which the matzah comes to symbolize, the acknowledgement that God was in control of that historic event and can be found behind every event in the future. Therefore, the Torah commands us to eat matzah and chametz, five types of grain, wheat, barley, rye, oat, and spelt, that come into contact with water for 18 minutes or longer. We stay away from that on Passover, and we talked about how it refers to shaking off God's sovereignty, a certain egoism, or haughtiness, and therefore we get rid of chametz from our home and our personality. Any questions just about this? Yeah, please.
Why is it not just enough to like abstain from eating chametz? Like, why do we need to go through this?
It's a really good point. It's not enough. Like, and by the way, we go crazier than we do, let's say, non-kosher food.
Yeah.
Because non-kosher food, we just don't eat it.
Yeah.
I can technically have benefit from non-kosher food, not actually from an admixture of meat and milk.
Okay.
But let's say non-kosher food. Okay, I'm not supposed to eat it, but like we go further because we want to completely just, I'm just saying, just keeping in line with this philosophical idea that I developed, we just want to just get that out of our lives completely. We don't have any exposure to it for these 8 days. We just want to consume matzah. We just want to eat that which represents the belief in something greater, stay away from anything. I said, don't possess it, don't own it, don't just completely taboo. It's taboo. And I think this is one of the reasons our Bubbies and Zadies went a little crazy before Passover. They understood that it was a very serious thing. There are a lot of prohibitions in the Torah about it, you know, and it was always taken pretty seriously. So what do we do? Let's go through a couple of the steps. We clean out our entire homes and places of work. Again, if you're at work and your friends are eating chametz, you don't have to, like, smack it out of their hands. Don't you know it's Passover? I'm like, Christian? No. No, as long as it's not yours, it's not an issue. All chametz food items which are sealed and would constitute a monetary loss to the owner if disposed of are sealed in a closet. Now, that's if you don't want to get rid of all your chametz. I'm not going to eat it, but I don't want to throw all this. I got, you know, three boxes of Cheerios. What can you do with them? So then you can put them away and then sell them. Okay, now I have a sale of chametz form. Do we have forms out there? Sell of chametz forms. If anybody wants to take one. And next week, you can bring it back. It's a 2-second form that you fill out. And I don't actually sell it. I will take it and bring it to another rabbi who probably brings it to another rabbi who eventually is going to sell it to some very wealthy Gentile who's going to own a lot of Jews' chametz. Now, he doesn't become so wealthy, but he will be buying. Now, you think this is like a game. You don't have to rely on this. It's better to get rid of it. But we're trying to make this doable for people. This heter, which is a leniency, started for business owners that had large inventories of chametz and didn't want to have to go out of business. So the rabbi said, okay, figure out a way that we can sell it so you don't own it. Now, you just want to be careful that you don't inadvertently come across it. And because you're used to eating this. By the way, that's another reason we're so strict. Like non-kosher food, if you keep kosher, it's taboo all year. Here, we're taking food we eat all year round and saying, not for eight. So it's more likely a mess up is more reasonable. You know what I'm saying? So we sell the chametz to a non-Jew. This involves giving the rabbi your name and your address and where your chametz is stored. There's only one rabbi in Manhattan that I know of who requires them to give you your key. Very few people are comfortable doing that because he wants to give the Gentile access to his property. By the way, what would happen if you would actually eat your chametz that you sold? What's that? Well, number one, you're in violation of eating chametz. But number two, what else are you in violation?
Stealing.
It's not your food. It's not yours.
It's not your property.
It's not your property.
You sold it, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's not your
And then we do what's called two other things that are really important. We do a bedika and a bi'ur. Take a look on 4 and 5 on the second page. Bedikat chametz means we do a little search. A search is a real search, by the way. It's not just a ritual search. You really, literally look around your home. When do we do the search? So the first night of Passover is Monday night, the following Monday night. So Sunday night you would do the search. The custom is to place 10 pieces of bread around because you're going to make a blessing and maybe you really cleaned really well and then you don't find any chametz and you've taken God's name in vain and made a blessing for no reason. So just to make sure, we put a couple of pieces of bread. You then search around and then gather up those 10 pieces of bread and any chametz you find. And then the next morning, you do two things. You, right afterwards, you do what's called a bittul. A bittul means you verbally nullify. And I have the nullification on the next page if you want to see it. I encourage you to say it in English so you actually understand what you're saying. But I can do this. If my watch... I own this watch, so I can visibly... What's your first name again?
Chase.
So if I just say I'm relinquishing ownership of this watch, and I leave it there, and Chase takes the watch. Take the watch for a minute. Nice stole one. My watch. now, what happens? Is that a problem?
Yeah, because it's not his watch.
It's not my watch.
It was
nobody's watch, though. Why is it a problem?
If I just found it here... No.
After you heard me verbally relinquish ownership...
Oh, yeah, you can.
Yeah, I said, I hereby... I didn't gift it to you. I just said I don't own it. You picked it up. Find his keepers.
Sure, that's mine now.
Yeah. By the way, that's a whole tractate in the Talmud. If I don't give up ownership, but you find something like that in a public area, anybody know what the rule is according to Judaism?
Bring it to lost and found.
You have to try to find the rightful owner if there's a sign.
Really? Yeah.
If there's a sign, then you assume the owner has not given up. Mm. As long as the owner has not given up, you have a responsibility to try to find the rightful owner.
What do you mean
owner.
A sign?
Like a sign on the watch of who the owner is, or how to get it back.
Kind of wallet with the idea.
If you found a wallet with an idea, very good. $20 bill is no sign unless somebody wrote Bob.
$20 bill on the floor. There's no sign, so I can keep it.
In the public area, if you're in someone else's home and you find $20 on their floor.
Terrible.
Then, you're like, oh, I just found it. You know,
in your house.
It's in Bob's home. Give it back to Bob. Right. So, I mean, these are rules and laws, but. But we do the same thing with the chametz. You can verbally nullify and just relinquish ownership on anything, and then whoever picks it up, it's theirs. You know. So that's another thing we do. And then we verbally, and take a look at the verbal nullification. By the way, I encourage everyone to do this, because even if you did a poor job actually getting rid of your chametz in your home, if you verbally nullify it, take a look at the bottom where it says... First, we burn the chametz the next morning. You burn those 10 pieces of bread, whatever chametz you find, and you say the words, any chametz or leaven that's in my possession, whether I've recognized it or not, whether I've seen it or not, whether I've removed it or not, should be annulled and ownerless like the dust of the earth. So it's literally not yours anymore. So therefore, and that, by the way, helps a lot because people call me, Rabbi, I found some chametz in my home. What do I do? I'm like, did you do the nullification? Yeah. I said, so you're fine. It's not yours. Mm. You have no relationship with that chametz. You want to probably cover it with something so you don't inadvertently pop it into your mouth. Because even though you have no technical relationship, you still may eat it. And that's a problem. But that's what we do. And we get very detailed with these rules and these laws. Because the more detailed you get, the more it becomes part of your life. And the more it becomes part of your life, the more these ideas can be internalized and be transformative. Because if it's just an idea and it's not concretized in an action, it'll be here today and gone tomorrow. You know? Any questions? Any other? Yeah, please.
I'm really fascinated with this idea of possession. Like, I didn't before coming here, I didn't really think about it. I guess, does the Torah have, some rules of possession? This idea of ownership of mine, I just think it's super interesting.
So it's really interesting because even though if I were to, take that beautiful necklace you're wearing, and I just grabbed it, it's theft. I have to return it. I may even have to pay a penalty. If you want to press charge, you know, like all sorts of stuff that according to halakha. But the reason why we are commanded to give charity, and charity is actually a bad translation for the Hebrew word
tzedakah.
You know what the word tzedakah actually means? It means righteousness or justice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, tzedek, right.
Right, tzedek is justice. Mm-hmm. So if you look up in Webster, charity, it's from the Latin word caritas, not that I speak Latin, I looked it up, which means Christian benevolence or goodwill. It's like a nice thing. Like if you give somebody who's poor money, you're a nice guy. In Judaism, it's justice. Because we don't really fundamentally believe that we completely own the money we possess. But for the sake of possession and the society, we can't have a society where, oh, you don't really own anything, so I'm just going to borrow that or take it. Can't do that. It's called stealing. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the Ten Commandments, not to steal. You're not permitted to do that. So we do recognize, the halacha, Jewish tradition, does recognize personal property. But on some even deeper fundamental level, everything is a gift, which is why you have to give some of your money away to charity, because it's not entirely yours.
And it never was.
It never was. This is difficult for people to accept, and this can get a little controversial. This comes up with issues of abortion and other types of things as well, my body, my choice kind of thing. Judaism doesn't view the body as our own possession either. We view the body as a gift on loan, which is why the Torah prescribes rules and laws governing the body. I'm not allowed to simply take my life. I'm depressed. I'm upset. I'm not saying, God forbid, somebody is not really in control of what they're doing. This happens, of course. But if someone is actively choosing and intentionally no, or to maim themselves or to harm themselves, that's a very serious Torah prohibition. Why? Because it's not our bodies to do as I please. And that very much runs up against a lot of other ideologies in our society, but it is a very authentically Jewish concept that the physical world is really a gift. That's why we make blessings before we eat food, because the blessing allows us to enjoy something which otherwise was just on loan, depending on how you use it. Well, we can have that conversation in another class. I teach this a lot when we talk about blessings. That a blessing is just acknowledging the source of where it comes from, but then you're using the gift in accordance with its divine imperative. So you're not stealing, so to speak. You're not like using something because it's in the world. Who said I could take it? Who owns the world? Oh, it's mine. If I buy that piece of these are radical, weird ideas, but it comes up with Passover, if you want to really sell your chametz. You don't have to sell chametz, as I said, by the way. You can just get rid of it if you want.
What's the story behind the feather, the wooden spoon, and the candle when we do the circle?
You don't really have to. Those are all nice customs. And it's a good thing to know the difference between a custom and a rule. None of those are rules. The rule is that we try to search out and make sure we don't have any chametz. So the night before Passover. So a lot of people like to use the feather. And they use the wood spoon, and then when they burn the chametz, they use the wood of the spoon to burn it. I'm not sure where the feather came from. The candle is really to be able to go into nooks and crannies and into little, you know, that's why I don't think you should use a candle. I think you should use a flashlight because it's a lot more effective. Now, so what I do is because the blessing is really over a candle and we want to maintain the tradition, I make a bracha over a candle, and I spend the first minute or two with the candle, and I blow it out and continue
with
that. Because it's, I don't want to start a fire in my apartment, so I'm draped it when it's home. And that's the reason the rabbis instituted the search at night. So it's easier at night when there's some darkness and you're shining some light to actually find things when everything is light.
You're supposed to turn off the lights then?
No, you don't have to turn the lights off. You don't have to turn the lights off. But that's when they instituted it at night because they thought it would be easier to actually see the little things that you might, you know. But I just want to caution everyone. Sometimes people go a little crazy with this stuff. Like, I saw this funny video, I think I mentioned at the beginning of class, of some guy, you know, scrubbing his toilet seat cover, and I'm like, why is he doing that? You could do spring cleaning, but you don't have to look in rooms where you never bring food. If there are rooms, like a bathroom, where you don't commonly bring food, then you don't have to check that room. You just check rooms where you brought food. If you like to munch at night, you know, in bed, you know, whatever it is, then you probably have to check there as well. Yeah, question?
No.
Yep. That's okay.
Yeah, it's like very, it's just, I wash my cat's bowl in my bathroom. So would that be hummus?
It depends what you're feeding your cat in the bowl.
Oh, like.
Is it hummus?
Probably. Some of it's dry food, but the stuff that I only wash is the wet food. It's only in the sink. I'm not going to, like, it's the sink.
That's fine. Then it's
is your pet considered Jewish?
No, I don't think so. I mean, pets, by definition.
I don't know, it's interesting. It's like,
his name is Eli.
Just the idea of, like, possession. Of
somebody
like,
invited me to their dog's bark mitzvah. I kid you not. No. Their dog's bark mitzvah.
Are you serious?
Oh, yes.
Did really invite you to that?
Yeah, I got invited. Invitation and all.
Did you do the service?
I did not perform the service. Wow. I wasn't properly trained.
He didn't study it.
I don't know how to officiate over service.
What if you eat in a sandwich... And you move, go to the bathroom, there's crumbs falling out of your mouth. Technically, you've contaminated the bathroom.
Hands and knees.
I mean, you just have to...
And then what's the cutoff for that bathroom? Say it's like, oh, a year ago I had a sandwich in there.
Well, technically, it has to be edible food in order for it to be chametz.
Well, I mean, it's
so a tiny little crumb is technically not really chametz.
What if it's some
people, you see all those books? There are some people who will go through...
Because
I like munching down, and I have a library like this at home. I like eating when I'm studying and learning all the time. So I got little crumbs all over the place.
So are you going to go like...
No, I don't do it. Okay. It's not considered chametz if it's so nothing.
Is it this similar to
It has
like
to be something you would eat.
I'm okay. Sorry, like 190th? Okay. Is that like so a similar thought?
No, it has to be something that you could eat.
Okay.
Like a bag of
yeah, question.
Yeah. Pretzels or something like that.
I don't know. That's a good question. You need 10 men for a minyan. You need 10 men for a minyan. I don't know why. I don't know that the custom developed. I don't know when the custom started to place 10 pieces of bread. I don't know, mate. I don't know. You got me. I'll have to do a little research.
Zeke said something about...
Do you know? 10? Why 10?
10 commandments.
10 commandments. There are a lot of 10s in Judaism. Yeah. There are other numbers, too. Like, why not 7? 7's a big number, and... 18's a big number, you know. I'll tell you, a lot of people, one of my rabbi of blessed memory used to, so not this Shabbat, but the next Shabbat, I'm going to do a big Q&A. It's the Shabbat before Passover, you know, with last minute questions that people have as they're preparing. But I remember it's called Shabbat Hagadol, it's the Shabbat before Passover. And the rabbi usually gets up and gives a long discourse about all the rules and laws of Passover, because it's so filled with rules and laws. And he said, you know, you should do something to prepare, but don't go crazy, because it's literally driven people to the Catskills and to Florida. Okay, because I think a lot of people are like, oh, it's just too much, I'm just going to go away.
Yeah.
You know, now, I think people just want to go away, so they can have a little vacation, but... It's not supposed to be that onerous that it prevents you, that it like incentivizes you to like leave your home. So I don't have to clean it. Okay, you just have to clean those parts where food gets, and then take the food that you have and put it away. Now, if you want to cook and all that, you're welcome to stay for the next class. I'm going to be talking a little more of the specifics if you want to, how to kosher a kitchen, how to make your kitchen kosher for Passover. Okay, that is more work. It's not crazy either, but it's a little more work. Yeah.
You can't use the same plates and knives.
You know, if it was, generally speaking, we use separate stuff. You can use paper if you want to.
Oh, so we just buy paper.
You can just use paper if it's easier.
Like a pot.
You can't use the same pots and pans technically.
Some people have like a third kitchen, huh? Like
some people have. Well, where do you get three? Oh,
no, I'm saying like someone really wealthy would have like a third under.
I don't know
basement.
Anyone in Manhattan with three kitchens.
Yeah,
no,
not here.
Yeah. No, I think paper's okay. What do you can get?
I know some people do the toothpaste.
Now, you know, anything that's not edible as human food.
Yeah.
So there's a famous story because the Talmud defines edible as ra'ui la'achilat kelev, something which you would serve to a dog. So somebody came to Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was one of the great rabbis of the 20th century. He said, last night I served my dog toothpaste and he ate it. So does that mean now that I have to have kosher for Passover toothpaste? And Rabbi Soloveitchik said, first of all, you should never serve your dog toothpaste. It was foolish. He says it's a category. If generally speaking, you wouldn't squeeze a little toothpaste into the bowl for your dog, then toothpaste is not something that has to be checked for. There is another category that if you start considering something food, even if it wasn't originally food, but now you're getting into a lot of the details. We don't have to go there. Generally speaking, medicines and cosmetics and things like that are not in the category. It is a problem with certain medicines if it's some might distinguish between medicines you have to take, because they do use as binders in some medications. They will use some chametz derivatives in, but if it's just keeping the food together, then according to some many opinions, then it's not really considered food.
Okay.
You know, and therefore it's okay.
So that's one of the reasons people go away, so you don't...
You don't have to deal with all this.
No, I'm like, maybe I should have gone back to California.
But I thought that even if you go away, you still have to, like, denounce the ownership.
Yeah, you got to do all these things before. You just don't have to blow up the kitchen if you're not there. I was a joke about
that. Most people cook, though, and they just have, like, one separate pan. Like,
if you cook, most people who cook will have their... kosher for Passover pots and pans. They'll kosher the oven, which if you have a self-cleaning oven is very easy. Just put it on a 3-hour cycle. If you don't, then you have to clean it, leave it for 24 hours and burn and put it on the highest setting for an hour. It's a little of a pain, but it's not so difficult. And then after you've koshered the oven, you cook your kosher for Passover food on your kosher for Passover pots and pans.
Okay, I just have one more question. So let's say I just buy a new pan.
Yeah. Easy.
Dip it in the mikvah.
Yeah.
And then use that for the week, and that pan is no longer K for P. And every year I just buy a new pan.
Yeah.
One cheap pan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Eggs for a week.
What's the deal with peels? Like some people peel their vegetables. Is that like legitimate?
I'm not following.
What do you mean? People who peel their vegetables.
I do that.
What does that mean?
I like peels vegetables, the skin. Don't worry about us.
I don't get it.
Because you guys are hardy, man.
Whoa. What do you mean? Just in case chametz got where?
On the peel?
On the peel?
Wait, if it's grown.
So why can't you wash it?
We know, Rabbi.
Many good questions.
Wait a minute, I thought
that's hardcore.
Wait,
I've never even heard.
The reason why they do it is it's grown next to the crops. Then that's. I was talking to someone that said that, like, quinoa, if it's grown next to the crops, then that's an issue. So you kind of...
There is kosher for Passover quinoa.
Yeah, so maybe...
By the way, I just want you to know there's been an explosion in the last 25 years of kosher. I mean, just growing up, like, I mean, even my dad's generation, like, they had potatoes for, like, 8 days. It was... They didn't have much.
Yeah.
You know, you're restricted a lot. It's so easy today. It's just more money.
Yeah.
Well, also, certain Muslim and I think certain Hindus, they, because kosher is more strict, encompasses, so they, if they're looking for something that's
well, that's good
kosher
that,
to them,
yeah, and it makes,
buy kosher.
It's good because it makes it more of a market.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because a lot of these places can't stay in business when we're small people.
Yeah.
What's your name, by the way?
Danielle.
Danielle, welcome.
Thank you. Just a general question about Passover. So when you describe God's presence in our life, you kept using the word involved, which is, like, to me, is passive. And I'm wondering why you're not using an active.
Like, what word would be better? I mean, involved.
Just sound like too passive, and to me, as a Jewish woman, I see God everywhere.
Beautiful.
So,
some of us struggle with that. You know, I do believe intellectually that God is everywhere. And when I hear that story, the story I shared with you about the RPG and the tank, that makes me feel like, oh, it's like a reminder, you know?
It's not passive at all, though.
Not at all. So he's actively, maybe we should use just that word, that God is actively involved in our lives, even if we don't always see it. That was actually one of the great lessons of the Purim story that I tried sharing. That even though God's name is mentioned nowhere in the whole Purim story, Megillat Esther, and it looks like God's not involved. It's just like this bad guy Haman tried to kill the Jews, and we had a Jewish queen in the palace. She saved the day. But God is there. He's actively involved. Yeah.
But then does that mean that there's different degrees to which he's more or less active? Like, if there's a whole, if there's a deeper reality that we can't even perceive,
yeah,
then how would we even know when he's, like, obviously in the story of the RPG, he's more actively involved, or we feel he is.
Yeah, we feel it more.
But in, like, for certain things, like right now, like, there's nothing that's, like, out of the ordinary happening, but
yeah,
the fact that we're here at all, I don't know. That's
yeah,
kind of
I think just because we don't perceive something doesn't mean it's not reality. Now, I'll tell you one thing, and then the Kabbalah goes crazy about this. The Kabbalists believe that the moment God stops infusing the physical world with his spiritual energy, the world will revert back to its primordial state of chaos, of tohu vavohu. Okay, now, does anyone feel that God is pumping his spiritual energy? So here's the best analogy, and the Baal HaTanya gives this. Listen to this. Think about it. Think about yourself as a child in utero. What consciousness does the child in utero have that it is being sustained through the umbilical cord by its mother? Zero consciousness. Okay? But we know that the second the mother, God forbid something happens to the mother, or the mother decides for some crazy reason to stop supporting its child, what happens to the child? It's finished. So that's what that's the way the Kabbalists like to talk about the connection between God and man and humanity, is that it's an intentional, it's not just like he created something and it just perpetuates on its own. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks of Blessed Memory said this beautifully. He says, a human being, we create something from something. God creates something from nothing. Ex nihilo, it's the Latin term yesh me'ayin. In order for something from nothing to stay, the creator has to continually support it, continually pump its energy into it. And that's what we believe Hashem is doing. But how many times do we feel that? How often do we feel that?
Very little. There's also the saying, which is a big blessing in what you cannot see. Samoi minayin, meaning.
What is it in Hebrew?
Samoi minayin.
Right. Right. Oh, thank you. Okay, great. Thank you, Carmen. It's beautiful. Okay, we're going to finish up here. I want to pass, if anybody would like to fill out the sale of chametz form. If you're not going to be here next week, you can fill it out now and give it to me, and you can authorize me on your behalf to sell the chametz. I'll be giving it to another rabbi who will give it to another. Eventually, it'll get sold. You can bring it next week, or
so
you can
fill it out online also if you scan the QR code.
Excellent. There's a QR code.
Like
that was embarrassing. You can do that too. But I encourage you to do it. And
we also, the Passover Seders, if you want details for that, feel free. We also have an Israel trip in the summer.
Woo!
It's a volunteer Israel trip. We're partnering with Birthright. The dates are July 28th to August 4th. It's a pretty cheap trip to Israel. It's about $800.
Well,
so if you'd like to join us and help volunteer,
it's pretty amazing. We also want to wish a belated Mazel Tov to Chani on her being honored at the MG dinner. It was amazing. Those of you who haven't met Connie, Connie's been with us for like 20 years. A little more than 20 years. Amazing. And Ellie, we want to welcome Ellie. And you know Ellie Sullivan, she's there. Just wave, say hello. Yes, unbelievable. And guys, come next week at 6:45 for the mock Seder. And if anyone's around this Friday night, I'm going to be speaking about Israel and life, something from the Parsha that reflects, I think, something happening that's going on in Israel today in a very positive sense. That'll be services this Friday night at 6:30 and then Saturday morning at 9:30. I'll be speaking about some more Passover stuff. If you'd like to join this Saturday, I'd love to have you. That's here. Across the hall, 9:30 to 11:30, and there's a beautiful Kiddush afterwards. We do this every Shabbat. You guys are all always welcome. So Thank you for coming, everyone. And please, there's some cold pizza in the back. Please help yourselves.
Wow.
Yes.
Thank you so
Chase,
much.
Chase, and wait, what's your name?
Noah,
where are you guys from?
I'm Upper West Sider.
Yeah, me too.
Born and bred?
Born and bred.
Wait, so how do you know Mark?
Just fellow Upper West Siders. A friend introduced me to Mark, and
that's so nice.
You. But I discovered you from, I was listening to your podcast.
Which episode?
With Jeremy Garland.
Oh, I love Jeremy.
American Hot.
Do you know Jeremy?
No. But I'm
out. Yeah.